I can't actually bring this to motion because we don't have a quorum at the present time. I can't call the committee to order because we do not have a quorum at the moment. But we can get started with which one's first? Oh, Moran, Representative Moran. Ooh. Representative Moran, I know you're not a freshman, but I suspect you had something to do with the lovely cake. And I got to tell you, sugar, flour, and whipped cream is a great dessert for breakfast. We're going to take about 15, 20 minutes and on your bill, and then we are going to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Beautiful.
So, would you care to proceed, Representative Moran?
Yes. Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Happy Thursday. So, I am really honored and excited to be the chief author of this bill and introducing the work of NDC to this body. The Neighborhood Development Center has a 25-year track record of assisting low-income and minority entrepreneurs to become successful. Today, there are 650 businesses operating in the metropolitan area employing 3,000 people. Mm-hmm. The NDC model of comprehensive training with the high-risk population, high-touch lending, and ongoing technical assistance assures that businesses are successful. The businesses that they support are currently averaging 10 years in existence, twice the national average. Each year, these businesses return $12 million to the state coffers in income and state sales tax. This is a great return on the state investment, which is less than 10% of their operating budget. NDC successfully target equity funds to increase services to Black and Native American businesses. It has taken their model to Greater Minnesota, with a number of communities are prepared to implement their entrepreneur-focused approach. I would note a significant importance to this committee is that it costs NDC $4,974 to create each job, reiterating my earlier comment about a good return on the investment. I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Mike Tamale, who will provide more details and answer questions. And then he will also introduce one of NDC's most successful entrepreneurs. But as a side note, I just want to share with you guys, I represent District 65A, which is right outside of this capital on University Avenue going west. And many of those small businesses right there on the avenue are there because the investment and the support and the training that has happened with NDC. So what they are doing is a great investment. I know definitely for my district and around the state to create strong, vibrant businesses. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Mike Tamale.
Thank you very much, Representative Moran. And thank you, Chairman Mahoney. Thank you for letting us be here this morning. I really wanted to thank Representative Moran for being the lead author on this bill, and a number of you in this committee have signed on to it, so we really appreciate that. We have been able to talk with many of you individually, so I'm not going to go into any great detail here this morning. I did want to thank also Representative Gunther, who's not here, but I'm looking at his name tag, so he will hopefully be here soon. But he's really the one starting about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, that began to encourage us to look beyond the Twin Cities and see if there's any application for our approach in Greater Minnesota. So we've been doing that with your help, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit. We do have a model that is able, in the most unlikely of places, to find, educate, finance, and incubate burgeoning low-income entrepreneurs, thereby lifting entire communities over time economically and socially. We're not doing this for the individual entrepreneur only. We're doing it for their entire community, and we try to cluster these entrepreneurs in their community so that they do, in fact, lift up their entire community as they go. We know what an entrepreneur looks like and how to assist them in building their skills and ambitions, starting with extensive business plan training. That's where they start. But then they move into financing, and because they can't usually get a loan from a bank, we're the one that lends to them. It is high touch, high risk, as Representative Moran said. The last 2 years in a row, we had under a 3% default rate with a portfolio that's 100% folks that can't get a bank loan. After they open their business, we stay with them with all sorts of assistance. Could be legal, could be accounting, marketing, restaurant management, et cetera. We don't do the work for them, but we teach them how to do it, and we correct them when they're messing up, which happens pretty often. These are real businesses. They pay market rates of interest. They pay real taxes. They pay real rent. Their average wages for these 3,000 jobs is over $14 an hour. So it's a good foot on the ladder. It's not the top of the ladder economically, but it's a good foot up on the ladder. On average, we create about 45 new businesses a year with about 180 jobs. As Representative Moran said, it costs us about $4,900, according to Wilder Research, to create each job, and about $28,000 of programmatic money and our operating costs to create one business. We made over $5 million in loans with the with the money that we received from DEED and from the legislature in 2017 and 2018. We used that and leveraged our other funding to put out $5 million in loan capital and over 13,000 hours of one-on-one technical assistance with experts for our businesses. And we made capital improvements to the Midtown Global Market, the Mercado Central, and other business incubators that we have. We also reached out to over 110 communities in greater Minnesota. I'm happy to talk in more detail about it later, but I'd like to bring forward four folks that have joined us this morning who are to our entrepreneurs and to our community members that we're working with in greater Minnesota. So if I could ask Kim Nagel from Bemidji, Robert Aitken from Leech Lake Financial Services, Frank Brown from Minuteman Press, and Eddie Wu from Cook St. Paul to fight over the two seats here.
Mr. Kamali, before you leave the table, Representative Robbins, did you have a question directly for
Mr. No, just that.
We'll ask at the end.
Thank you.
We are trying to stay on a tight timeline. So for the testifiers today, a couple, 3 minutes at the most, if you could, please. Appreciate it. I know that really 3 minutes is really almost impossible for Eddie, but Mr. Wu runs a restaurant in my district, which I populate regularly.
Well, thank you, Chairman. I am happy to say I'm a longtime member of Toastmasters, so I know what 1 to 2 minutes means. I'm Kimberly Nagel from Northwest Minnesota. I've been doing entrepreneur development for the past 30 years. 2 years ago, NDC, along with Mary Matthews, CEO and founder of the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund, approached me about running around the rural areas and identifying could we adapt or adopt the NDC approach in those communities. And we did it by listening. We didn't do it by saying, hey, we have this approach, and everybody listen up. And what we heard from people is that there are resources in rural Minnesota. They are disconnected. They are not always focused on the entrepreneurs that are fed by the NDC approach and that are so necessary in our rural communities. And two big gaps that we've identified as we went forward are training and technical assistance. But more importantly, I want to give most of my time this morning to Mr. Robert Aitken, who is the executive director of Leech Lake Financial Services and one of those entrepreneur development programs that could be well suited to adapt or adopt that NDC approach to maximize the work that they do and increase the outreach, thus increasing the business growth in our rural communities, filling our downtowns and our main streets.
Thank you.
Bonjour, Representative Mahoney. And Miigwech committee members for having us be able to testify and share our story today. My name is Robert Aitken. I run Leech Lake Financial Services, which is a nonprofit. We're not affiliated with Leech Lake. We're a separate 501c3 that serves the Leech Lake community, which means we serve everybody that lives within the boundaries of the reservation, including 25 miles outside. Our market has a 20% predatory lending rate. Nationally, 4% is the average. So we've been alive for 6 years at Leech Lake Financial Services, and we've been targeting and hitting consumer lending with financial education. So that's what we do, is we provide affordable loans with sensible financial literacy and financial education. So our model is really to help consumers build credit so ultimately they can become bankable and become stewards in a community. NDC has shown us the way for commercial development. As we build our consumer base, we've got commercial lending. But on Leech Lake, in the Cass Lake area, it's virtually an economic desert. There's two basic employers on the reservation, tribal government and the casinos. We need entrepreneurship. So we met Michael and went to NDC, and they came to the reservation, and we looked at that model, and we think it can work. And we're going to go for it. We've already implemented some of the strategies that they have for training our entrepreneurs, and we're having success getting ready for our first entrepreneur loan to close this spring so we can have a reliable, accessible mechanic. That's where we're at. We'd love to be able to tell you that we're into solar technology and silicon chips and things. No, we need our people to keep the money local instead of going to other communities just to do something simple like get an oil change or get a new set of tires. We need to start offering that to our community. And the model that NDC has is going to work for Leech Lake. So I'll conclude my time. We're happy to be here to participate with NDC because it's a model that we've seen work and we know it's going to work on Leech Lake. So thank you, committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Mr. Brown, please identify yourself for the tape.
Okay, my name is Frank Brown. I'm the owner of Minuteman Press Uptown. Good morning. I've owned Minuteman Press for 4 years, and I wouldn't have been able to get it started without NDC. NDC gave me training. I mean, I have a bachelor's in business and accounting. I have an MBA. But they basically, my higher education just taught me how to join a corporation and manage within a corporation, but they did not teach me the skills of running a business. So I developed those skills by going through NDC's training, and it was really helpful for me to run a business. I would have been lost without that training. They've also provided me technical skills when I bought my business, as far as getting a purchase agreement together, as well as, you know, some of the ins and outs of union negotiations and setting up my original union contract. As far as accessing loan, I would not have been able to have my business if I wouldn't have gotten a loan from NDC. You see, I have a criminal record. I made a mistake 20 years ago, and I took responsibility. I changed who I was, and I paid for my crime. And when I got out, I even made amends. So me, after turning my life around, trying to apply for a loan, I had me and my wife, we had credit over 700, 725, 750. We had one-third down, took my money out of retirement to get this business going. I went to a bank for a loan. 30 years experience in printing, couldn't get a loan. And I was pretty sad. But luckily, NDC was around. NDC helped me get my business started. And when we bought my business, we bought it from a couple that had no employees. Today I have 6 employees. When I bought my business, their sales was at $200,000 a year. Last year we grossed over $1 million, and that's like the fastest growing Minuteman Press in the country. So NDC has supported my success as I continue. I go to them for technical advice. They have helped me with union negotiations. You know, I give back to my community, and without NDC, there's entrepreneurs like me that can't give back to their community. I pay a livable wage. I remember when I went to the union, the lowest wage was $8.25. I said, I'm not paying that. Let's move it up to 12. And when I found out living wages was 15, I raised my wages to $15 an hour. Also, when the sick and safe time came out, I was ahead. We implemented Sick and Safe Time when I first heard of it, helping my community, you know, have good jobs and have time to spend time with their children. So I also hire people with records. Criminal justice system has really affected my community. I live in North Minneapolis. And, you know, how are we going to get entrepreneurs out of our community to help our community without institutions like NDC? When I think of NDC, I think of a movie. It's called It's a Wonderful Life. And there's Jimmy Stewart. He said about the Bailey Building and Loan, we need this one-horse institution. Well, we need NDC. We need that one-horse institution for my community.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Wu.
Hello, my name is Eddie Wu. I own a restaurant on Payne Avenue in the east side called Cook St. Paul. I've been working with NDC for about 4 years. My business has been open for, April will be 5 years. I started with a business partner, a friend of mine since kindergarten, a tale as old as time. Nothing could have gone wrong. Everything went wrong 2 months in. He bailed on me, realized he didn't want to have any part of owning a restaurant, and I was thinking fast. About 6 months in, I got a loan from the NDC. It was less than a week that they got it to me. It was $10,000, and that kept me going. Since then, they had someone come out. I was a lit major for the time I did spend in college. I don't know QuickBooks. I don't know all that stuff. I could have wrote a nice poem, but the bank didn't want it. So they sent someone out once a week for 9 months to teach me QuickBooks, and they also sent a specialist out once a month to go over my food cost and beverage cost. I've worked in restaurants since I was 14, and I'm 39 years old. My naivety is what got me to open the restaurant, think I could do it. And I know I can do it, but there are a lot that I needed to learn that I didn't know. And I've been open, like I said, 5 years in April, and it just came out this month. All 5 years I've been named in the top 50 restaurants in Minnesota, which represents about the 4%, the top 4%. There's less than 10% of those restaurants that have made it all 5 years in a row that I have, and I'm in that. So, once again, I don't know math. Someone can figure out the math on that. But on paper, I'm pretty successful. Behind the scenes, it isn't what people think it is. I've done over 100 pop-ups where other chefs come into my restaurant, and I see the struggles that they go through, and I try to pass the skills that I've learned from the NDC onto them. And it's, you can speak of specific instances where the NDC bailed me out in the form of the first loan. I currently have two $20,000 loans with them, and then the support administratively. But if you really look at it, I look at it over the past about 4 years, so I could name about 1,600 times where they have bailed me out, and that is because every day that I'm here, it is because of them, and that is no hyperbole. It is, I've been named by the press as the beating heart of the East Side because of the new business that they're going there. And if I am the beating heart of the East Side, then the NDC is the medical team that holds the defibrillators that keep me alive every single day. Because, once again, it is no hyperbole. I had one day off in February, and I will work, and I'll work, and I work. And I come, my father was a St. Paul firefighter. I was in the Marines. That's all I know. All my skill set and all my drive and all my grit will do nothing if I don't have the skills that the NDC learned. And the last thing I have to mention on that is I'm a mildly educated, middle-class, English as a first language, white male from South St. Paul, Minnesota. With all my struggles, imagine the struggles that the majority of the population that NDC works with have as immigrants, English not as a first language, communities of color. And that's really what the NDC is here for, and that's why we need the NDC.
Thank you. Thank you. And I do want all of you to understand that Cook is an absolute fabulous restaurant, good lunch, not far from here, and I kind of enjoy the mac and cheese.
Just mac and cheese. Kimchi mac and cheese. That's my lit major getting in there.
Representative Moran? We are quickly coming to the end here. So do you have any, are there any questions? Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran and testifiers, thank you for being here. I don't really have a question, but I am a huge fan of NDC. I've seen your work in my previous business life, and I can't say enough about it. And Obviously, the testifiers speak for themselves, but congratulations to all of you and to NDC, and I urge everyone to support this.
Thank you. Any on that note, do you have any closing comments?
So, yes, I do. So as you guys have all heard, the stories here are the stories that's been replicated over and over and over for individuals in the Twin Cities and now in rural Minnesota. It's a model that can be replicated, and it works. If we're going to work towards reducing and eliminating our economic disparities that is a burden on our state, this is definitely one way that we can do this, and it's working. I just want to give a quick plug. You guys have this in your package. I hope you do. Legislators and members, if you're ever up here and you need to run somewhere to get a quick meal, we have four of businesses that you can run and pick up something really, really good that is full of ethnicity and culture. So on that, I just say to Mr. Chair, thank you for this hearing, and to members, hope that we can have your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moran. With that, we're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you to all the testifiers that came today. Thank you to all the NDC members that brought some of the treats out there. I tried as many as I could, but even I can't eat that much. Representative Mason. House File 1744, and we're going to, I'll move 1744 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. While you're getting there, we have a quorum, so I'd like to call the committee to order. And where's my copy of the minutes? No, I got them right here.
I read it well.
Representative Moore, Knorr moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none. All those in favor of the minutes as written, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. We now have minutes. Representative Mason.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about House File 1744. And I think all of us have been aware of, in many instances, the contentiousness of divorce. And there's a concern about how divorce affects the well-being of children. A large number of studies have compared children with divorced and continuously married parents. And almost all of these studies found that the children with divorced parents have poorer outcomes on average than do children with continuously married parents. In general, the accumulated research shows that children with divorced parents compared with children with continuously married parents exhibit more conduct problems, emotional problems, often have lower academic success, and have more problems with social relationships. And parents are also affected with feelings of depression, loneliness, regrets. So this is a family. Well, actually, it's more than a family. It's a community-wide problem. In general, the children have found that children's adjustment to divorce is directly related to how their parents respond and react to divorce. So this bill, House File 1744, will establish a family law mediation task force to advise and inform the legislature about the impact of conflict on children during the marital dissolution and work to develop a process to reduce the conflict that occurs during the normal divorce process. The Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services will provide the support staff, the office, and administrative services for the task force. And the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Service, or the Commission designee, will also convene the first meeting of the task force. And they will elect a chair, and they will. The suggestion is that they meet monthly, or however they decide to do it. the best way to help people during the divorce process is a cooperative resolution process at the time of the divorce. And it is the intent of this legislation that we will set that process in action.
Thank you.
And I'm prepared to take questions.
Does your testifier have any anything to add to your sales pitch?
I have a few comments, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
My name is Diane Anderson. I'm a former state representative, and there's a lot of research out there about the effects of divorce on children, and she referenced this one report right here, but there's numerous reports out there regarding the effects of divorce on children and how the adversarial court process often causes a very negative impact upon children and families, and we should find ways in Minnesota that we can move away from this adversarial court process. The non-adversarial process can help to reduce the hostilities that often accompanies parenting issues. This process can help the parents minimize the conflict they have with each other, and which will help to minimize the negative consequences on their children. And a non-adversarial process can also improve voluntary compliance with parenting issues and the things that the parents have to deal with after the divorce. So it's a really good idea to have this task force so we can have a very effective way to bring people together to talk about this issue, get information from professional people who understand the issues that people that are going through a divorce experience, and a way for us to come up with some ideas and solutions that we can use here in Minnesota. So we really would like to find a better way to have a divorce process that will teach people how to reduce the conflict between the parents and help them to better parent their children, give parents tools and how to deal with the other parent, give parents information to help them through the process, and the goal is to have healthier families and children. So basically in 2017, there were 7,447 divorce cases involving children. In 2018, there were 7,444. So we have a duty to help these parents with their children affected by divorce and better equip these families and help them with their lives after the divorce. Thank you.
Thank you. We are hearing this bill because it's in the Bureau of Mediation Services, so I do not want anyone to get the fear that we are getting into family law in this committee. I've spent 10 or 12 years working on family law. It gets me into a cold sweat. Do you have any other test? Mr. Elwood?
I do.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Just want to say, first of all, Legal Aid supports this bill, and second of all, have spoken with Representative Mason prior to the hearing. We had noted that Legal Aid and organizations that are representing victims of domestic violence are not yet included in the task force, and wondering if that might be something that would be a valuable addition. Representative Mason graciously said that's a good idea, and I think we might want to make that amendment in GALOPS.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions or concerns? Is there anyone from the public, anyone else from the public that would care to testify on that? Seeing none. Representative Mason, any final words?
Okay.
Bill?
Again, I think we all know how many families are impacted by this, and we need to be doing better for our families. So I'd really appreciate your support for this, and we'll move this back to Ways and Means.
Thank you. So I will renew, the chair will renew his motion to pass, to, wait a second, are we passing this, or are we
referring to it?
We refer to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Representative Mason, you are on your way to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Dabney, House File 295.
How much of this is yours?
Oh, I'm going to possibly include this in my omnibus bill.
I like the sounds of that, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'll allow you to make that particular motion, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I ask that House File 295 be before the committee for possible inclusion in a division report or omnibus bill or whatever you care to call it.
My nightmare to come.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I have the A-19 author's amendment, and I want to thank the Department of Labor and Industry and Unite HERE for helping simplify the language and clarify some of the language in the bill in the A-19 amendment.
You care to move the 0147 amendment?
Please.
Would you care to explain what does it do to 295? Simplifies language?
Simplifies language, and principally it clarifies the existing language in the bill says that if a server receives a tip, that they receive that tip during the pay period. The challenge with that for restaurants and bars is if I receive it on Saturday night and the pay period ends on Sunday, they may not have the time to process that and get that to me within that pay period. This allows them to extend into the next following pay period.
All those in favor of the 0147 amendment signify by saying, are there any questions on the amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. You have your bill in front of us as you would like it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Let me tell the same story I told before Chair Sundin's Labor Committee, because I think it illustrates it well. One night I was leaving here a little on the late side to connect with some community activists on another bill, and it was an informal conversation, so it was going to happen in one of the fine establishments in my neighborhood. And I realized I was down to my last $2 in my wallet. And I was running late, as I usually do, and we were going, we're connecting at a restaurant. And so I went down to the ATM on the ground floor to find it was out of order. Well, that's okay, because the place will take a credit card. Hooked up with my folks, food was eaten, beverages were consumed. At the end of the evening, the server divided the bill three ways. I had got my portion, and I left a $4 tip. If I'd left that $4 tip in cash, I could be assured that the waitress got a $4 tip. But I'd run out of money, and the ATM didn't work, and I wanted to get to connect with these people, so I left it on a credit card. And under Minnesota rule, that tip can be taken from her, parts of that tip can be taken from her by the restaurant charging her the business cost of running the bill and the tip on the credit card. And the restaurant charging back the transaction fee that the credit card company charges them, not against their cost of doing business, as is dish soap and napkins and straws and all of that, but charging it against the employee who earned the tip. House File 295 repeals the rule in Minnesota that allows employers to take from the tips of their employees. This is simply wage theft. There's nothing different from what restaurants who choose to do this, some do, some don't, than if the manager was going into the waitress's purse while she was out on the floor and taking a couple of bucks out of the wallet. I think people who earn tips should get the tips that they earned. With me today is Wayne Luneberg from Unite HERE, Local 17, and he would like to speak to the bill.
Good morning, Chair Mahoney, committee members. My name is Wade Luneberg. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Minnesota State Council of Unite HERE Unions and also the political director here of Local 17. We have 6,000 members here in the Twin Cities in our sports venues, convention centers, 22 union hotels, and restaurants. Today I'm here to speak in favor of House File 295. Tips are the sole property of the direct service employee. That's the rule. That is, in fact, a conflict in the situation and in the rules. Unite HERE believes that debit and credit card fees are a cost of doing business. Our members and servers in general also know and rely on tips and gratuities being the sole property of the server. Servers are paid only a minimum wage by their employer, and we believe that customers largely understand that. So tips become a contract between the server and the customer for the service provided. There's a lot of expectation from the customer that there's also an expectation from the customer that the server is getting the whole gratuity, whether delivered in cash or on a credit card. The server, a minimum wage earner, and the company's salesperson happens to be the one handling the physical transaction with the customer. Because the server has had the bad luck of receiving a tip on a credit card that day, they're being penalized. Nowhere else in an operation of a bar, restaurant, sports venues, or at MSP Airport would a cook, a host, a steward be nicked for a credit card fee. I'll use my debit card or credit cards a few times today to buy gas, groceries, or a meal. Each time I have to assume there'll be a charge on that card to the business, but I'll have confidence that they won't be able to take or assess a worker's earnings to pay for it. As consumers move more and more to plastic, there's no doubt that large industries like hospitality, retail, and personal services should be negotiating with the financial industry for better terms on credit card charges. It's a structural problem with the system, and one that should be sorted out by industrial titans and not by the person who brought me dinner. So thank you, and I hope you can support House File 295.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would care to testify for or against House File 295? Come on down.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Ben Logsland. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota, also representing restaurants here today. Also want to thank the Chair for meeting with me recently to talk about some of our concerns on the bill. Although models vary, credit card processing fees cumulatively currently range between 2 and 3%, and Minnesota law currently allows restaurants and other businesses to pay their fair share by paying that 2 to 3% on the portion of the tab, the food and the beverage tab, and requiring the tipped employee to cover the 2 to 3% processing fee on the tipped amount. Tips are not fixed costs like soap or dishes or cookware that ultimately benefit the business, but instead are a variable cost dependent upon the server-customer interaction, and the sole beneficiary of the tip transaction is the tipped employee. As a matter of fairness, it seems reasonable that the employee would share in his or her portion of the cost to be able to access the benefit of receiving a credit card tip. I would point out that earlier was mentioned an ATM, accessing your funds from an ATM machine. There's a cost to accessing your money from the bank, a small portion of that, and so there is a cost to access money, and this is what is at issue here. The restaurant pays their fair share of 2 or 3% on the tab, whether that's beverage or food, and the server pays 2 to 3% on the portion that they can receive through their tip if it's a credit card tip. While some of our members currently do absorb this cost as a benefit to the servers that work under them, not all of them are able to do so. It's been discussed that restaurants operate on very, very thin margins. It's a very tough industry, with some reports indicating that over half of restaurants fail within the first year and up to 80% failing within the first 5 years. This is very competitive, and 2 to 3% margins and different things like that, in addition to other mandates that are being placed on restaurants and small businesses in some jurisdictions, make it increasingly hard to sustain the business. We believe that these businesses should be able to preserve the right to have this flexibility, and I would also note that currently nearly every other state in the country acknowledges the financial constraints on these small businesses and allows for this. That being said, given the totality of the circumstances, we think a more acceptable solution to an outright ban proposed in this bill would be to require businesses to clearly disclose to their customers what their policy is. The restaurant members that I have talked to indicate that they clearly disclose what they do, whether they do or they don't, to their employees, and that transparency is very important to them, and that when they explain their policy and why they do what they do to their employees, that they are understanding, and they understand that there are different business models and different margins of being able to do this. Finally, because the issue of theft was raised earlier, I just want to say, currently under Minnesota law, wages are not treated, or tips are not treated as wages. These restaurants that do choose to assess a 2% fee onto tips so that the server can access that money, they don't get that money. This is money that is going to the credit card companies and the processing companies, so they're not taking that money for themselves and for their own benefit. I think given the current state of law that, wages are not treated, or tips are not treated as wages, if the legislature decides to go in a different direction and look at tips being wages, then, maybe we want to consider having a two-tiered wage system that, we have favored and advocated for in the past where tips are considered as wages. So, again, I'm happy to continue to talk to the author and others about a different solution to this, but we feel that a one-size-fits-all solution, as is in this bill, does not make sense. Most states in the country do not do it this way, understanding that these small businesses have very, very tight margins and need this kind of flexibility. So I thank you for your time and attention. Happy to continue to talk with the author and others about other ways to deal with this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Chair. Representative, my question is so there is that cost, and as we've heard, most businesses, especially restaurants, work on a very limited margin. So what's your anticipation? Will we see higher menu prices? Because, they're only making a 1% margin, and this is a 2-3%, and I know where you're coming from. You want to make sure the person gets what they deserve with the tips and so forth. But at the end of the day, if that business is not profitable, then there's no employment. So what's your thoughts? Are we going to pass this on as higher menu prices, or what's your thoughts there?
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Backer. That, of course, will be up to each individual restaurant on how to handle that. Mr. Wagland's right. It's tough being a small business person. It's tough being a small hardware store. It's tough being a small dry cleaner. It's almost impossible to have an independent bookstore. But none of those, if I pay by credit card at the hardware store, they don't deduct it from the employee's wages. If I pay by credit card at the dry cleaner, they don't deduct the transaction fee from the employee's wages. If I pay for a book at an independent bookstore on a credit card, they don't deduct the transaction fee from the employee's wages. If I pay for a bill at a restaurant or a bar, they shouldn't be deducting the transaction fee from the employee's wages.
And I can appreciate that too, but as a business owner myself, when somebody buys an item from us, or if they buy an item from a hardware store or something like that, we're not getting a tip. So this is, I appreciate what you're saying, but it is a different variable because in the examples you've given, outside of possibly a bar, representative, it's not a tip situation. My only concern, and I know what you're trying to do is noble, and I appreciate that, though from a business perspective, people will only pay so much for a particular item. And then if the customers don't come back and buy those meals and so forth, then they're out of business. We've seen that in other industries with the tariffs. There are several businesses that are struggling because the prices of items went up 10-20%. Now, I realize this is only 3%, but when your margins are less than 1%, I'd share that with you. That's my concern because they have employment because the businesses are there. But if we're going to put an additional recommendation from the state on those people, that business may not survive. So that is and, of course, I'm really looking into small towns, too, because small towns are different than in the metro area. You don't have the volume of people there. So I have those concerns, too. So thank you for visiting on that.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Any other? Oh, Representative Moran. Oh, wait a second. Nope. Representative Koznick. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair.
I just had lots of different papers here.
I can wait. I'm okay. I don't think we got time. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. And I had a couple questions for the gentleman. I apologize I didn't get your name from the Restaurant Association. Something, you know, we all go eat at restaurants and probably don't give a lot of thought to us. So, Representative Dabney, I appreciate the conversation, and it's interesting. So on regular wages, there's taxes and revenues that are generated to the state. If you could comment on what those are for the committee so we can have a baseline on that first, and then I'll have a follow-up.
And that is fine. Please proceed. But we are going to hear the Department of Labor and Industry today. So keep your comments as brief as possible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, are you asking about taxes on both tips and the base charge of the tab? There are taxes that are assessed on both. Obviously, if you collect or are paid via credit card, that's very clear what the amount is and what's taxed on both.
Mr. Chair, if you could just kind of briefly, and I don't want to belabor the point, but just to kind of get an understanding, if they're paid $15 an hour, what are the Social Security taxes and other fees and stuff that the employer participates in and the employee also pays into? And then the follow-up to my question, and you can just lead into it, is on the tip part, how is those collected if there are wages and such or not, maybe?
Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, I don't have those numbers right in front of me right now in terms of how that breaks down on the wages. I don't know if staff has breakdown on the taxes, but I'd be happy to get back to you on that piece of it.
Does staff have the breakdown on those taxes? No, we don't. Representative Koznick.
No.
Oh. Mr.
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding is that tips or wages are considered income for state and federal tax purposes, and they're treated the same as any other income. So reported tips are income, and FICA and other taxes are taken on those.
I think that's good. I was hoping for a little bit more specific, but I get it. That's outside the purview of this a little bit. But I guess my question then being is, are all the tips that Representative Dabney may pay when he meets with his constituents or myself with my constituents in Lakeville, the tip portion, are all those state revenues generally paid on those tips as well?
That is my, Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, that is my understanding. So to the staff's point, tips are currently treated as wages for tax purposes, but are not treated as wages for the purposes of minimum wage. This is the issue of, you know, two-tiered wage system or different proposals such as that that have been, you know, debated in other jurisdictions and before this body. But if you currently pay with a credit card, the state can be assured that it's getting the full range of what's supposed to be paid in taxes. If you pay in cash and the cash tip goes to the server, of course, it's on the honor of that server to report what those what those tips are to make sure that the full tax that is supposed to be paid is included.
Okay. My point being is that I'm guessing that a lot of tips are not being reported in that, and there has been a different bill in the tax committee that maybe the businesses should be reimbursed for collecting, doing a share, a service to the state by collecting those revenues. And that's why it's an interesting bill that in concept there are kind of a few different moving parts about that that may be a little bit more complicated than the author's bill addresses. But I appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. To testify, just for some clarity, so each time someone uses a credit card, there's a 2 to 3% charge that goes to the restaurant, right? So that happens every time. You have to pay 2 to 3%. So if someone uses a card to pay for their bill and they give the employee a tip, I think I heard you say they also had to pay a share of that at 2 to 3%. Is that correct?
So currently, and again, there are restaurants out there that eat the entire cost, the 2 to 3, and 2 to 3% is a range. So As was mentioned before, these are negotiated rates with the largest credit card processing companies in the nation and in the world. As you might imagine, a small business might not get the same rate that a larger corporation does on that. So this plays out differently in different parts of the state depending on what your business is. But currently, some restaurants eat the entire 2-3% of the costs on both the tab, meaning the food and beverage cost, and the tip. Others that are on tighter margins and on what is allowed currently under law choose to go with a different model. They pay the 2-3% on the food, beverage, tab, and on the tipped amounts only, they deduct that from the tipped amount from the employee so that server is able to access that money, the money that they've been tipped. And again, it's a the server is the sole beneficiary of this piece of the transaction between the customer and themselves. And the restaurant receives no benefit from that. And so the way we view it is that really it's a fairness issue or a balance issue. In order to access the money through that transaction that the server is being allowed to gain, they're paying the fee to access that money.
So, Mr. Chair, for clarity.
Yes.
So the employee is splitting the 2-3% with the employer, the restaurant owner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I wouldn't say that they're splitting it because typically the tip, well, it depends on how much is left for a tip, right? So it's not being split. The 2-3%, it would be 2-3% of whatever the tipped amount is that the server would be paying under that model. They don't pay the 2-3% based on the base charge of the tab and the food or the beverage.
So the business is splitting it. We're like, we're going to pay for this, and you're going to pay for that.
We'll pay our fair share for the amount that on the tab. You pay your fair share on the tipped portion.
And is that the way the IRS, Mr. Chair? Is that division? I mean, I'm just trying to understand. It's one charge on a credit card total. So I'm kind of like not understanding the 2-3% that is charged on the total amount anyway. But we have the employee also paying 2-3% on a tip, which makes it at 4-6%.
If I might interrupt, yes. I think that's a little bit, there's some confusion there, and I'd ask you to take that offline because I'm trying to get and leave enough time for the Department of Labor and Industry.
All right, I can do some follow-up.
2 seconds. Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, the one thing that I'll say is
not helping your case here.
This is the practice in almost every state in the country to allow this structure. That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions for the testifier or for the author? Would you care to say it's a good bill and it should be laid over?
It's a good bill and it should be laid over, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Thank you all.
The bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I am going to move to item number 6 while the commissioner is coming to the table. That is, we're going to be moving the following house files are returning to Ways and Means with a recommendation to be re-referred to the capital investment. A week or so ago, I asked if anyone specifically wanted a hearing on their bonding bill. Representative Mecklen asked, and when I assured him that his bill was going to bonding, he wisely succumbed to the chair's wish. So we are moving them all over to capital investment, and the chair of the capital investment will make decisions on which one she hears, and my understanding is they're hearing all of them somehow or another. Representative?
Mr. Chair, we might denied the committee an opportunity to have some free treats, courtesy of Becker.
I'm getting fat as it is.
Stop. You might want to reconsider. I don't know.
So right now we are going to have the Governor's Department of Labor and Industry budget presentation by the Commissioner, by Commissioner Leffitt.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for inviting me to your committee to present the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's budget recommendation for the Department of Labor and Industry.
If I could stop you for a moment.
Yes.
Members, I move item number 6 on the agenda. Are there any concerns or questions or comments. This motion will return the listed bonding bills to Ways and Means with a recommendation for referral to capital investment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. We now have 30 bills off our table, and we do not have to have as many night meetings as we were planning. Commissioner, nice to see you in the committee. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. I'm Nancy Lepink, and I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and I have here with me
Heather McGannon, assistant commissioner at Department of Labor and Industry.
Christy Swanson, the finance director of Department of Labor and Industry.
Thank you. So the Department of Labor and Industry has a significant role to play in ensuring that all Minnesotans share in the prosperity of the state's vibrant and diverse economy, and to ensure that that economy is built on the foundations of decent work. Work that pays a fair wage, work that is safe and supports health, and when work injuries and illnesses happen, provides needed protections and benefits. Minnesota's continued prosperity also depends on the development of a workforce that is prepared through lifelong education and training for the future of work, a future that will be driven by technology, globalization, changing demographics, and environmental change. To prepare for that future, the department works alongside its many partners to prepare the next generation of workers through its support of apprenticeship programs and young worker training programs, which play a much-needed role in preparing Minnesota for the future of work. And in the coming years, we will need to continue to ensure the resilience and sustainability of the state's buildings and homes. The state's construction codes and skilled trades women and men will play a critical role in that effort. While the department is committed to ensuring that it is using its current resources in the most effective and efficient manner to serve the people of Minnesota and fulfill the promises their government has made to them, the governor's budget for One Minnesota strategically focuses on four areas of critical need for additional resources for the Department of Labor and Industry, and I will discuss those in this presentation. So to begin, I would like to briefly review the agency's base budget by division for FY 2021. So to begin, 34% of our expenditures go to the benefits paid to injured workers who are covered by the Minnesota's workers' compensation system. Only 10% of the expenditure is for administration of the workers' compensation system, which ensures appropriate benefits are delivered to injured workers quickly, efficiently, and at reasonable cost to employers. 4% of expenditures are being used to develop a modernized workers' compensation information and claims management system. This project will be completed in December of 2021. Then the second largest expenditure, 27% of the budget, is in the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. The division collects and issues license and permit revenue to develop, inspect, and enforce Minnesota's building codes, and to license skilled trades women and men and residential contractors. OSHA makes up 10% of the total expenditures. OSHA makes Minnesota's workplaces safe and healthy through education and enforcement. Then, of course, there's general support functions, 10% of expenditures, and is funded through a direct appropriation from the Workers' Compensation Fund and indirect cost allocation among the various divisions of the department. The labor standards and apprenticeship each comprise 2% of the total budget expenditures. Labor standards protects Minnesota's economy by ensuring workers and employers understand their rights and responsibilities for the payment of wages and required workplace standards. Apprenticeship supports Minnesota's economy by promoting, facilitating, and developing quality apprenticeship programs that require, train, and retain a highly skilled workforce. The Contractor Recovery Fund, which is used to assist Minnesota homeowners who have been harmed by the misconduct of a residential contractor, makes up 1% of the department's expenditures. The revenue in this fund is from a surcharge on residential contractor licenses. Next slide. This chart sets out the department's budget change items. The department's budget change items reflect a $11.3 million proposal, which is 4.6% of the Department of Labor's total budget. However, only $4.775 million, or 1.8% of the agency's budget will be an ongoing increase to the department's budget base. So now I will present the details of the seven governor recommendations in the following slides. However, many of them have no revenue or expenditure consequences. The governor recommends $3.55 million in FY 2021 for the Department of Labor and Industry to expand its strategies, including stronger enforcement to achieve compliance with wage theft statutes. Wage theft occurs when employers do not pay their employees what is owed them for all work performed. The Labor Standards Division is responsible for enforcing Minnesota's child labor, minimum wage, overtime, and prevailing wage laws. In addition, the division is responsible for enforcing Minnesota's laws that regulate when and how wages are to be paid and recorded, and laws that relate to leave and other conditions of work, including the Women's Economic Security Act, which provides accommodation for pregnancy and nursing mothers, parenting leave, sick and safe leave, and the right to wage disclosure. The Department of Labor Standards, the Department of Labor and Industry's Labor Standards Unit receives more than 20,000 requests for assistance and responds to approximately 1,600 complaints each year using various levels of intervention. In 2018, the Department of Labor and Industry conducted nearly 1,900 wage theft investigations and helped workers recover more than $1.1 million in wages they were owed, and brought noncompliant employers into compliance using both assistance and enforcement interventions. With the additional $1 million appropriated to the Department of Labor and Industry in the last biennium, the department was able to respond to additional complaints and provide assistance focused on wage theft violations. The governor's budget would increase the Department of Labor's wage theft appropriation by $3.55 million over the FY 2021 biennium. This increase reflects the governor's commitment to change its current approach to wage theft prevention and enforcement. We would add 7 investigators and 2 support staff to increase and improve the department's capacity to detect, investigate, and bring workplaces into compliance through tailored and targeted enforcement and compliance strategies that will engage and leverage stakeholders and other parts of government. As the business practices that result in wage theft have grown and have in many sectors become the way of doing business, a more concerted strategy needs to be developed to counter those practices. The governor recommends additional funding to double the number of youth skill training partnerships and provide grant resources to create and implement employment-based training programs for 16 and older students in high growth, high demand, and living wage occupations. The governor's recommendation includes maintaining 1 FTE to ensure the effective management of this in-demand and growing program. The current individual who has been working in that program and managing that program, that position will expire in June 30 of this year unless additional funding is obtained. There is an increasing number of unfilled positions in well-paid, high-growth jobs that require certification or a 2-year degree in specific trades like manufacturing, information technology, and healthcare. These industries and others are struggling to find qualified employees throughout Minnesota. The youth skills training programs provide meaningful exposure to careers in these critical industries and a pathway for students 16 and older to acquire the skills employers are looking for. It also provides, as we have found in our recent visits to Red Wing and many employers there who are participating in this program, it also provides valuable information to them about what young people are looking for in a job and how to better market their industries to this future workforce. The Department of Labor and Industry's Youth Skill Training Coordinator has met with 50 actively engaged youth skills training partnerships and served 3,150 Minnesotans in this past fiscal year. The program awarded $2,388,000 in grant money requested during its first round and $3,160,000 in grant money requested in its second round. So the the significant importance for this program individual to be able to continue to engage with communities and with all of the stakeholders that are needed to be involved, need to be involved in developing these programs and providing ongoing support to those programs as they grow and evolve. And so consequently, all of the people that we have spoken to said that this role is critical to them in order to understand the program, understand what their responsibilities are, and furthermore, provide ongoing support during the duration of their grant. The governor recommends $3 million in FY 2020 to complete the program that it has embarked on several years ago, to replace an outdated system by building a new information technology system to provide ready and easy access for all parties involved in a workers' compensation claim to manage their claim on their terms online in real time. The new workers' compensation information and claims management system will allow real-time interaction with workers' with the workers' compensation claim system and easier and quicker access to claim information among employers, insurance companies, medical providers, injured workers, and attorneys to ensure work injuries are reported, treated, and compensated using a streamlined process. The department has been working closely with all of its stakeholders in the development of the system and will continue to that engagement as the project is brought to completion in 2021. When DLI requested funding back in 2015, the agency was just beginning scoping the system replacement project. The fiscal request was for initial funding as initial system review costs ranged from $16 million to $52 million. The Department of Labor has spent the last 3 years reviewing internal processes, working with external stakeholders and other state agencies to determine system needs. The final project will require an additional $3 million in funding. Any unspent funds will be returned to the Workers' Compensation Fund from which that $3 million would come. To ensure the success of this project, the Department of Labor and Industry and MINIT have established a robust governance structure that meets regularly to review and monitor timeline, budget, risks, and project progress. This project has hired an external assessment team comprised of industry experts that conduct regular review of the project's progress, development, and quality. Sorry. The governor is also making a recommendation requiring contractors that install residential solar photovoltaic systems to be licensed as residential building contractors or remodelers. In 2018, the Department of Labor and Industry needed to revoke the electrical licenses of a solar contractor and its owner, who were paid close to $2 million by Minnesota and Wisconsin homeowners and businesses and who failed to perform the promised installations of solar energy systems. The solar contractor enticed customers into making substantial upfront payments on solar systems that were never installed and left affected homeowners with little recourse to recover their money. So by requiring solar installers to be residential building contractors, it will ensure the contractors have the appropriate knowledge for installations on residential building and protects homeowners by allowing them to access the contractor recovery fund. The contractor recovery fund compensates consumers who suffer a financial loss because of a licensed residential building contractor's misconduct. Solar installers would contribute to the fund through a surcharge on their license, and if any homeowner in the future experiences misconduct, they would have access to partial reimbursement for the harm that they've been caused. We anticipate that 50 solar contractors would be impacted by this new licensing requirement related to Minnesota residents. Yes.
If I might ask, where did you come up with that number 50? I mean, everyone under every rock in the world nowadays seems like there's some kind of solar installer wandering around.
Well, I believe it would be based on their current licensing obligation, but I could ask Scott McClellan to advise you as to where the department arrived at that number. Scott McClellan is an assistant commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. Currently, we have approximately 40 contractors that put themselves out as solar installers that are licensed electrical contractors. And we also are, we work with MNSEA, the Solar Association in Minnesota, so we have pretty good numbers as to who those people are and who would need to become licensed should this become law.
I'll ask offline.
Okay. Real briefly, Mr. Chair, to that point, you had mentioned a surcharge. Since we're on the topic, what is the surcharge amount to these contractors?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a building permit surcharge, but I think what we were referring to in our presentation is an assessment as part of the license to become a residential building contractor license. There's a $320 fee that goes into the contractor recovery fund. And that fund is available for homeowners then that are followed by a contractor that they can make a payment into the fund or receive payment from the fund.
Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's $320 fee. The commissioner mentioned surcharge, so that's the term I used. Times about 50. That's what's built into your budget, or is it higher than that? Or what are the new
Mr. Chair, Representative, $320 per license, correct? And that's okay. Renewed every 2 years. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. So on the occupational safety and health penalty conformance, Congress recently passed legislation that increased the maximum penalties for the federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration to amounts approximately 1.5 times higher than Minnesota's maximum penalties. Minnesota now needs to align its penalties to make them consistent with the federal occupational safety and health penalties. So all employers in Minnesota have a legal responsibility to ensure the safety and health of their workplaces and the work they ask their workers to perform. And all workers have a right to go home safe and healthy each night to their families. The Department of Labor and Industries Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Division has the responsibility to ensure safe and healthful working conditions for Minnesota workers through on-site inspections, consultation services, education and training, outreach and awareness raising. Minnesota enforces its own workplace safety and health law and receives half of its funding to perform this important work in the form of matching grants from the Federal Department of Labor. To meet the requirements to receive those grants and to operate its own state program, our laws must be at least as effective as federal OSHA's laws. Without being a state plan state, Minnesota would be preempted from engaging in any kinds of legislation or rulemaking related to safety and health in workplaces by the federal law. But as becoming a state plan state, we now have the authority and have since 1974 to regulate ourselves, and also to assure that those regulations are responsive to the needs of Minnesota employers and Minnesota workers. Consequently, if Minnesota does not make the changes required in the federal penalty laws, it could lose federal OSHA funding and the right to administer this important program. However, if we don't do it and we lose our obligation right to be a state plan state, the penalties will go into effect anyway, because federal OSHA will take over this program and they will take over enforcement in the state. So there's no way out of this penalty obligation to make our laws consistent with the federal government. However, what will be lost, as I said, is how Minnesota OSHA has tailored this program to meet the needs of Minnesota workers and employers, and also the mechanism by which it issues penalties, which does allow for significant credits to employers who have operated in good faith, who have occupational safety and health management systems, who are otherwise working to do an effective job related to occupational safety and health. Those kinds of considerations are not available under federal law. Also under the scenario, 750,000 state and local government employees would lose coverage for safety and health, because federal OSHA does not cover public employees. Also, it should be noted, Minnesota OSHA has not increased its penalties since 1991. The governor also recommends a $5.2 million increase from the general fund to update the department's technology platforms that support the program, its programs and services provided to Minnesotans. This would be an initial appropriation of $3.2 million, in the first biennium, with an additional $1.7 million in the out biennium. As part of DLI's continued efforts to preserve and improve service delivery efficiency and effectiveness, the department seeks funding to modernize its information technology application portfolio and underlying technical infrastructure. Specific systems, including those that support the Occupational Safety and Health Division, apprenticeship, the Construction Codes and Licensing Division, and internal systems in the General Support Division. These systems and platforms that we are looking to spend the money on will no longer be supported in FY 2021. We'll not be able to hire staff to maintain these old systems and codes, some of which are more than 20 years old. And we cannot guarantee security once the systems are no longer supported. That is the security of the department, employees, employers, and citizens' data. When we replace these systems, of course, we will take the opportunity to automate additional functions for DLI and stakeholders, work to allow stakeholders more online functions, and streamline internal processes for efficiencies. And again, as I mentioned earlier, DLI and Minit have a strong partnership. We work closely together, and we have had success in upgrading multiple systems in the past. And we also engage regularly with our stakeholders throughout these processes to ensure that they are meeting their needs and that they can use them well. And we have a strong governance structure with active executive leadership and very organized leadership to make those types of improvements. Then lastly, the governor proposes to reduce or eliminate license fees for combat sports judges, managers, ring announcers, timekeepers, doctors, and referees. The Department of Labor and Industries has the responsibility and has an Office of Combated Sports, which ensures Minnesota's combative sporting events are conducted in a manner that minimizes injuries and ensures fair competition. Currently, Minnesota charges a small fee to professionals and promoters to host combative sporting events in Minnesota. Minnesota's event fees are slightly higher than those fees charged in neighboring states. DLI's Office of Combative Sports licenses 250 professional and amateur mixed martial arts and boxing combatants each year. They monitor safety standards to ensure all combatants are medically fit to compete, are reasonably matched with their opponent, and events are staffed by safety professionals. So reducing these position fees will help Minnesota to become a more welcoming destination for events while still ensuring safety standards are met. So consequently, we are not competitive for these sports in events because our fees are slightly higher than those fees in other states. So the purposes of this reduction in the fee will be to encourage more of these events in Minnesota, for which there are many Minnesotans enjoy.
It seems though you're the big kahuna in that particular one. You get to call the balls and strikes, so to speak, if there's an argument. I want to be there for when you have to review it. You just don't seem like a mixed martial arts kind of person anymore.
I think you've made an appropriate assessment. Mr. Chair. Anyway, Mr. Chair, I usually don't opine on my personal preferences in a situation like this, but so anything for the chair. So anyway, if I have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Representative Sundin, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the commissioners, whoever wants to tackle this one. Firstly, I must say, the Minnesota OSHA does an excellent job as far as response and compliance, and it's much appreciated. But oftentimes when there is an incident and OSHA comes in with it's a pretty substantial fine. So many times it's negotiated down. At the end of the day, they end up paying half of what that fine ought to be. And I'm just wondering how those negotiations happen and why they happen in the first place. You know, if there's an infraction, that should be held up. I'm just wondering, is when the lawyers jump into the room, things change. Can you tell us how that process works?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin. So, first of all, you should understand that when the Occupational Safety and Health Division conducts an inspection, investigation, and finds that there's violations, it utilizes a longstanding matrix as to how, because most of our penalties are up to a certain amount, so the division has developed a matrix for how to evaluate, and that includes criteria that assist them in determining and what the amount of the penalty should be. And this one, of course, means that we're, in each instance, we're consistently looking at the same criteria to ensure that all employers and the workers that that our investigations protect are handled in a transparent and a fair and consistent manner. So when we then have issued a citation and a penalty, it includes that not only includes a penalty, but also includes the obligation of the employer to remediate the violation. However, if an employer objects to either the citation or the penalty, they have a right to do so, and they have a right to go to administrative hearing. So when we then immediately offer, if an employer objects, an opportunity for what is called an informal conference. So during that informal conference, there's an opportunity to informally for the employer to present additional information potentially to the department regarding the citations. Certainly it allows the employer to show that they have immediately taken steps to remediate the violation. And of course, it allows the department to communicate to that employer what was the basis for the penalty, how the penalty was calculated, so that they also fully understand how the department was operating. So, of course, for the department, the top priority is the remediation of unsafe and healthy working conditions.
I have
conditions.
Four people with questions. So
okay, I'm sorry. So consequently, in the context of that situation, our priority is to ensure to bring that citation, to make it file, and obligate the employer to remediate and maintain the remediation. So sometimes in those instances, there is good cause to reduce a citation to ensure that that happens. Sometimes there's an argument that the employer has made that obligates the department to rethink its citations. So usually that is the thinking that goes on in that circumstance.
Thank you.
Sorry for...
Thank you. I have my next question here. I know that you have been getting more and more into sustained youth training, pipeline, a variety of other pieces that appear more and more job training or apprenticeship programming. And I would like the dollar figure that you spend on all of those particulars, because you have a 10,000-person program in the apprenticeship program that is paid for by the multi-employer companies. And most of these pipelines and youth skill training programs are paid for by tax dollars. And I have to decide how much money I want to give those folks, unless everybody complains, because the multi-employer companies pay for it themselves, other than the $230,000, I think, is in the budget for administration. And I'm seeing more and more companies come to the Capitol to train their workers and then not contribute. Or they say, well, we put our machines out there for them to use, or we put them with somebody. I don't know about the painters, but I know the pipe fitters We pay for all the machines. We pay for all the equipment. We ask for a tuition from our apprentices, and we put somebody with that apprentice to train them, and we don't look at it any different as other than what we have to pay to keep our businesses alive. And so I'm still under kind of a concern or a question. No one has explained to me why they should get a free ride and I got to pay, well, when I was working, $40 or $50 a week out of my check to pay for the future. So I'm not understanding it. No one's been able to. They've come and pleaded with me. They've stopped trying to reason with me because they don't have any reason for it. Could you please tell me how much we're spending so that all of my colleagues here might understand how much we're spending giving a tax break or taxpayer money to businesses? Just a little irritable about this one, just if you haven't guessed.
So, Mr. Chair, I would turn this over
to the finance person.
Heather McGannon, who's the person who is responsible for the programs that you refer to.
Mr. Chair, I'm Heather McGannon. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. So with apprenticeship, just to give you some of the financial background, apprenticeship is $4.3 million that goes into that program. YST, that's per year. And for YST, that's a youth skills training. I'm sorry, the 2.3 is per biennium, so it's 2.1 per biennium. And then youth skills training is a million per biennium, so 500. And right now that is 500,000 goes into grants, and that 100,000 would go for the 2 years of the startup for that program manager. That's the position we talk about that is ending. For pipeline over the biennium, it is 1.5 million. And the pipeline program, in this case, we conduct the program. The actual grants that the chair has been referring to are from the Office of Higher Education. So with the programs, just to give a little differentiation, so with all the programs, the pipeline and the apprenticeship model, they are models. They are the earn and learn model. There are some of our apprenticeship sponsors, which are our gold standard sponsors. They have a model in which exactly as the chair mentioned, they pay in, the members pay in of those labor organizations to actually pay for the training and to continue the cycle. That is what we would like all of our employers to be able to do. But within the model, what we do have to have is we have five components that must be there in both the pipeline and the apprenticeship model, and that is that the apprentice or the pipeline dual trainee has to be employed. There has to be a program that is approved by the Department of Labor and Industry, which includes on-the-job training and related instruction. There needs to be a progressive wage scale, and there needs to be a certification. Yeah. Now, with the apprenticeship, They have that model that they regulate that within pipeline that is not regulated. But we do look at pipeline as a pathway, especially for industries that have not currently had a lot of experience in apprenticeship, to be on that way to registered apprenticeship. That's the way we look at it. And then our youth skills model is really a student learning program model.
And how much does the Office of Higher Ed donate to this cause?
So for the startup grants, they
just
are...
Just in total, I have 0 seconds left, okay. And your department has given relatively long answers, so I'm going to tell you need to shorten your answers up if we're going to get through all this.
Okay. I do not have the information of what they have and what they are able
Thank
to
you. I'll
award.
Get it. Representative Kosnick, if you've got a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're short on time. Just wanted to clarify, it sounded like 10 FTEs in the budget. One of the main questions was how much non-general fund revenue is built into your or non-tax revenue is built into your budget for this biennium? And then it just point out the two things on the technology. There's a couple different programs that they had in there.
By non-tax, you mean fee-based?
Correct.
Okay.
And then I just wanted to point out, good luck on the two technology initiatives. We haven't had a lot of success up here at the Capitol with that, but I think that's something that
actually, the Department of Labor and Industry has done really good work over the last 5 to 10 years. They've modernized almost all of theirs. It's got this one or two up. They've done great.
Okay, good. I'm new to the committee, so I work on transportation and MMRs. It's something that I don't want my fingers on it too much.
Just stay in your lane over there.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Commissioner. And then the other thing, the OSHA meeting the conformity on the penalties in that. I understand that discussion went over it rather briefly, but, there's some other conformity that we think might be helpful to job training, and we have a bill introduced for having conformity in Minnesota's OSHA standards to the federal standards to allow some 17 and 18-year-olds to work on construction sites and stuff, and maybe we'll get into that discussion this year. Maybe it'll have to wait for next year, but it's something that I'm glad to see the aligning and recognizing that conformity is good. So if you can just talk about that revenue portion. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we will give you the quick answer to the non-revenue funding for the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The department has a very small amount of general fund appropriation. It is Labor Standards Division, which is $3.9 million for the biennium, and then it is the pipeline program that is a $1.5 million for the biennium. Everything else is revenue-based or federal grant matches.
Seeing no other questions, I would like to thank you for your time and your explanation. And before we go, I'm going to, I don't know if all the rest of you got the invitation from the pipe trades and their contest. I'm planning on going. I always find it fun to watch people actually put metal into metal and make it look pretty. I actually think it's a piece of art, but I'm just weird. So I don't know. I'll make sure everyone gets a copy of that if they haven't got it already, and a couple of email reminders. Other than that,